You're listening to KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One. You ain't nothing but a hound dog,
you're crying all the time. The Peabody Hotel in downtown Memphis, Tennessee, first opened its doors back in 1869. An integral part of the Grand Peabody is the mallard ducks who live on the roof, and they've paraded twice daily through the hotel lobby since the 1930s. The Peabody is where Elvis went for his senior prom, and it's where Mr. Lansky, Taylor to the Stars, dressed Elvis in pink for his first live performance and continued to select his wardrobe for the next two decades. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer, reporting from the Peabody. Join me for a visit with Duckmaster Doug Weatherford. Afterwards, we'll stop in at the nearby International Blues Society in the Blues Hall of Fame for a visit with docent and local radio host Reed Malkin. Doug Weatherford, here you are, Duckmaster, right. The historian at the legendary Peabody Hotel in downtown Memphis, Tennessee.
That's right. Yeah, I'm from Memphis originally. I worked for Holiday Inns Incorporated for many years, and they moved me to the East Coast. And so I was gone for some time, but I suffered barbecue withdrawal and had to come back.
Had to come back.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Well, you do know that there are some people that know about this hotel in America where the ducks do this walk every day through the lobby, but they don't even know what state it's in. But they know the hotel and they know the name Peabody.
That's right.
You probably met those people, haven't you?
Oh, yes, many. There's a number of questions that I'm asked on a daily basis.
So the ducks walking in the lobby of the Peabody dates back, to the 1930s?
1933. The general manager, Frank Scott, and his buddy Chip went on a cold duck hunt into the chilly backwaters of the Mississippi in Arkansas. And they knew it was going to be a cold day, so they took along another companion, just for encouragement, a certain Jack Daniel, just for encouragement. Right. But as the day wore on, apparently they became a bit over-encouraged, and they began to feel it would be a funny idea to bring the live duck decoys, which were legal in Arkansas in those days, back here and release them in the fountain, and they did. Then they went off to their rooms to sleep it off. Well, the next morning, Mr. Scott was a little concerned about the mayhem that might have been caused due to his misdeed the night before. After all, he was the general manager. So he rushed down to the lobby and he found two surprises. Number one, the ducks were still here. They hadn't flown off to see Beale Street. A group of tourists and guests had gathered. They were delighted by the frolicking ducks in the fountain of such a fine hotel. So, of course, they were given a couple of days' reprieve, turned into an 85-year tradition.
Isn't that interesting? Literally true.
It is literally true.
Not a myth and legend.
That's right. That's right.
Let's talk about the historic connection of the Peabody Hotel with Memphis and Elvis, a lot of the seminal people.
The Peabody is the centerpiece of both early downtown history and the resurgence of downtown, both. Probably 80% of all American pop music was born within sight of this building, the genres of that music. Elvis's high school prom was held here in the mezzanine above our heads, and the people who taught him how to dress have a shop here, the Lansky. They dressed Elvis for 25 years, and he came in for the rest of his life and bought clothes from them. Would you like to hear how that began?
Sure, yeah.
Elvis, in the 50s, he was a senior in high school, and he would walk past the Lansky's storefront on Beale Street at 2nd and Beale. Bernard Lansky, Mr. B, stepped out one day. Now, Elvis was going to his part-time job as an usher in a movie theater. He'd walk past the front of Lansky's store, and he'd look in the window. And one day, Bernard Lansky came outside. He says, "Son, I see you standing here all the time. You never come in. Is there something I can do for you?" He said, "Well, I'm a local entertainer." He said, "Yeah, you're also the usher in the movie theater. I've seen you down there." He said, "Yes, but you know, I'm doing bigger gigs all the time. I think I'm going to be on local TV. I don't have the wardrobe for things like that, and your clothes look like what I should be looking at, but it's too expensive. I can't afford it." Lansky said, "All right, kid, you're breaking my heart. Come inside. I like you. I'm going to help you out. But you're going to have to listen to me because you're too shy. You're never going to make it." He said, "Is that right?" He said, "Yeah, what I'm going to do is dress you in pinks and blacks and colors like that to get the attention your personality is never going to get." Now, Elvis has heard enough about his personality. So he said, I don't think so. Men don't wear pink. I'm not going to do that. And Chulansky said, all right, forget it. And he started to walk away. Elvis thought, man, I better not look a gift horse in the mouth. He dropped his guard against the color pink. He called him back. He became obsessed with it. That's why the pink Cadillacs. And that started the tradition. And from that time on, Mr. Lansky advised Elvis through all of his early years on how to dress. And he's responsible for his image in a way.
That's interesting. Right here in the lobby, right by the ducks, there were some major deals done.
Yes, there's been a lot of things done here. For instance, the Colonel Parker, had been harassing Elvis for some time to let him represent him in contract negotiations for record royalties. And Elvis caved in here in the lobby of the Peabody. The Colonel was shocked. He wasn't prepared for that. So he ran to Mr. Scutt's office. He said, quick, give me a piece of stationery. He said, well, all I have is Peabody letterhead. And he gave him a piece of that. And the Colonel typed up the first contract representing Elvis for record royalties. And so that document sold for $85,000 at auction. Elvis was a minor, was 20 years old, too young in Tennessee to sign contracts. So his dad had to come in and co-sign. Vernon Presley's signature appears at the bottom.
There were some other musicians that have a connection to the Peabody.
Yes, as a matter of fact, when I first brought my wife to Memphis in the late 80s, we were standing in the doorway of the corner bar down the hall. It used to be called Mallard's Lounge. And we were listening to a gentleman playing the piano named Jason D. Williams. He was reputed to be the unacknowledged son of Jerry Lee Lewis. Well, he looked a great deal like it. He was, very lanky and athletic. He damaged 4 pianos while he was here, so possibly it was him. So we're standing there. My wife said, he's very good, just like you said, but I don't buy the stuff about Jerry Lee Lewis. That's just a publicity ploy. I said, all I can tell you is they say he comes in here all the time, and he doesn't deny the stories. And I looked around, and there he was, 2 tables over. I said, there he is right there. She said, that's not Jerry Lee Lewis. I said, yes, it is. She said, here, hold this. I said, what are you doing? And off she goes. She goes over to him. She said, excuse me, sir, I'm really sorry to bother you, but you're not Jerry Lee Lewis, are you? He takes a look at her, and he says, I sure am, darling, as he pats his lap there. So he looked up, and he said, now, is that big fellow standing over there your husband? She said, yeah. He goes, and you can't see me, but I'm gritting my teeth and giving a little tiny wave there as he looks sheepishly at me. So that was my exposure to early rock and roll.
Thanks so much for sharing. This is great.
You're welcome. I'm so glad you're here. Welcome.
My name is Reed Malkin. We're in Memphis, Tennessee at the Blues Hall of Fame.
So you're a local boy?
What we like to say is born and bred right here, or reared, depending on how you want to put it. But yeah, I'm a Memphis boy.
So music has been a part of your life forever, huh?
Forever. I can remember when I was little, I mean real little, we had a housekeeper, African-American woman, and my parents had a small grocery store. And she would take me on the bus, and I'd sit on the back of the bus, and she would take me to church.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So I was your babysitter.
Actually, my second mother, more than my babysitter. I mean, my mother worked. She's the one that raised me and my brother and my sister. And then when I was in the 7th grade, I had a Saturday job down on Beale Street, when Beale Street was Beale Street. And I used to take the bus downtown, walking back on a Saturday night on Beale Street at 12, 13 years old at 7 or 8 o'clock at night. You learn some stuff.
Talk to us about music and your connection and how it permeated your life.
It's real hard to grow up in Memphis unless you just don't know how to have fun. And there's plenty of people who don't in this town. But if you were someone who's susceptible looking for a good time, just music was all around you, always was.
What first clicked with you? What was your first affinity to music?
It might be sacrilegious to say it, but it wasn't Elvis. It was rhythm and blues here, much more for blues. I mean, it was definitely soul music. I can't tell you a specific song. I can tell you this. The first album I ever bought was the Isley Brothers' Twist and Shout, and I think I paid about 50 cents for it. Yeah, so there had to be something there. But Memphis always has had a treasure chest of great music, and it still does. Actually, that's one of the amazing things about Memphis is the number of really great musicians that have moved here recently because they dig the vibe. The saying is, you go, if you're a musician, you go to Nashville to be seen, and you come to Memphis to play music.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so that's the difference. People aren't here looking to become famous. They go to Nashville looking to become famous.
Here it's to do their thing.
It's to do their thing and be themselves, and there's fantastic music here. And growing up in Memphis, you know, we would lie about our age to get in clubs and stuff like that. So there's all sorts of, you know, to see B.B. King, to go see Jerry Lee Lewis, or just to go see all sorts of people of that era and genre. They would play high school dances and stuff like that. So it was a lot of fun. And then there were the old soul reviews that played in the auditorium. I mean, I saw everybody, James Brown. Actually, the housekeeper got me and my friends tickets for James Brown. We were about 14 years old. So it was the old auditorium. It was great. I can't play a note. And my wife says I'm the worst singer in the world. She wanted to learn to sing in the shower. But I love music. Always have.
Here you are right now. Where are we right at the moment?
Right now, this is what I do sometime. I volunteer here. This place has an important purpose, and it's twofold. One is to preserve the blues and give it recognition. What's most important to me is getting young kids here.
And the formal name?
This is the headquarters of the International Blues Society, and the museum is the Blues Hall of Fame. So we get school groups, and usually parents a lot of times bring kids with them and take them downstairs. Sometimes they don't want to go, but sometimes they come up smiling. So that's always a good feeling when that happens.
So you have, like, listening rooms down there?
We have listening rooms, and essentially there's over 400 artists who've been inducted into the Blues Hall of Fame. And via our various search engines, you can read a biography of everyone who's been inducted. You can hear them play, and the vast majority of them, you can watch a video of them playing. Yeah, so it's very cool.
So music is still a part of your life?
Yeah, it's always been a part of my life. I'm retired. When I was a lawyer, I represented a lot of entertainers. Now, actually, besides doing this, we have a volunteer radio station. I do a radio show tomorrow. It's a volunteer station. It's no commercials, no news, no sports, no weather, no anything like that. It's just people. Every program is a volunteer, and we play our own music collections. No one tells us what to play. We've been on the air 42 years, and we stream. So if you're somewhere where you got a computer or phone, you go to WEVL.org anytime, day or night, and you can hear some crazy person like me playing you their record collection.
And your name once again?
Reed Malkin. We're in Memphis, Tennessee, home of the blues.
And to learn more information about here,
go to bluesfoundation.org.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting in the heart of downtown Memphis, Tennessee.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com. Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
The Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative was recently awarded the prestigious Phoenix Award by the Society of American Travel Writers. HLRI was one of four recipients of the prestigious award that recognizes international organizations actively involved in conservation, preservation, beautification, and anti-pollution campaigns that further the growth and appeal of travel destinations.
Exploding in all directions.
75 years ago, World War II ended. It was the deadliest military conflict in history, resulting in 85 million casualties. We mark the anniversary of the end of that war by celebrating the heroism of our greatest generation, those who served and those who supported their efforts at home. On September 2nd, we will commemorate the signing of the Articles of Surrender aboard the battleship Missouri Memorial at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, a celebration of the peace that followed. Salute their service, honor their hope. Join us virtually for the events on September 2nd, 2020. For further information, go to 75thww2commemoration.org.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.